Well, I'm host Jordan Brown, and this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and it's always great for me anyway to get an injection of Joe Cocker. I've been enjoying some old rock music at Waiheke, a bit of Chuck Berry, The Stones, JJ Cale, and Eric Clapton even ended up doing a bit of dancing to it the other day. So, you know, there's still life in the old bloke. Anyway, this is Take It From Us, brought to you by Framework Trust, and of course Framework's big news is that it is merging with supporting with Connect, supporting recovery. The CEO has started on the merged company, but just doing a lot of research on social media, and this morning a nice little poem came up, headed up, "Don't beat yourself up for recharging." And it reads like this: if the mountain seems too big today, then climb a hill instead. If the morning brings you sadness, it's okay to stay in bed. If the day ahead weighs heavy and your plans feel like a curse, there's no shame in rearranging. Don't make yourself feel worse. If a shower stings like needles and a bath feels like you'll drown, if you haven't washed your hair for days, don't throw away your crown. A day is not a lifetime. A rest is not defeat. Don't think of it as failure, just a quiet, kind retreat. It's okay to take a moment from an anxious, fractured mind. The world will not stop turning while you get realigned. The mountain will still be there when you want to try again. You can climb it in your own time. Just love yourself till then. That lovely line at the end, just love yourself till then. Well, this is Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and I've been doing, did do quite a bit of research 2 or 3 weeks ago on patient assaults on staff and mental health units, and I stumbled on a paper published by news agency The Spinoff. It highlights the common use of illegal video surveillance of mental health patients by many DHBs throughout the country in acute mental health units. It raises many questions. How widely is this dangerous and illegal surveillance known in psychiatry? What, if any, consent is sought from patients? How regularly is this surveillance viewed by staff, and who has the okay to view it? And many other questions that we're going to ask our guest today. The revelations from this review of illegal surveillance was done by Karen Black, a guest writer for media outlet The Spinoff. And its findings are more than disturbing, and I'm surprised its release some time ago hasn't caused a storm among people with lived experience and among the consumer movement. So here to talk about the review is Karen Black. She's a former consumer advisor and now a current student advocate with Kahui Tu Kaha. So welcome, Karen, to Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. It's been a little bit of a time before you get your opportunity to say anything in the studio, but welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's kind of really good, I think, that you guys have picked up on this, and I'm obviously interested in the research that I've done. Yeah, so thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. So how did you come to review this issue of video surveillance or CCTV in mental health units?
So I completed the research as part of my consumer leadership role for Kahui Tu Kaha some time ago now. Kahui Tu Kaha has the contract to provide consumer leadership to Auckland District Health Board's mental health services, and so I reviewed it as part of my work.
So that was that's the wider ADHB mental health services, or just the acute services?
Yeah, so the consumer leadership contract is for all of mental health services within Auckland District Health Board.
Right.
Our catchment area, yeah.
So when did you complete this research?
So I completed it in October of 2017, but really the work that I was doing on it took about 5 or 6 months leading up to that.
So something tipped you off that there was video surveillance.
Yeah, so that sort of occurred. I'd just actually come back from maternity leave, I think, and a colleague of mine, I was having a conversation with them, and they were much more closely involved with providing leadership to Whetū Tāwhira, and they were saying that they'd had a number of concerns regarding security and safety for staff and patients and people who visit the service. So they wanted to try and look at ways that they could improve this, and CCTV was one of the ideas that was being floated at the time.
As something that would be mutually beneficial to both patients and staff, or was there a focus on staff safety?
I think those things are both equally as important, and that would have been the focus that they were coming from. I mean, there's perhaps people's things going missing, those sorts of things also of concern, property being damaged, that sort of stuff. Too.
Any more serious issues, though, like perhaps drugs being taken into hospital?
Yeah, I think that was a concern of the as well.
Right. So how did you go about identifying information, researching?
That's quite a good question, because it sort of just unfolded quite organically for me, I suppose. I was interested in three main areas. Firstly, I wanted to find out what other DHBs are using in terms of their CCTV usage. And then also, secondary to that, I was interested in, what patients and staff and family members thought about having CCTV operating in inpatient units. And so that component of it took, I sent out a survey to different consumer networks for different staff as well, to try and receive feedback kind of for what staff thought. And finally, I also completed a literature review looking at international examples where CCTV is used in inpatient units and looking at the findings of that. So there were really three components of it. It was an audit of what other DHBs are using in terms of their CCTV, the survey and the literature review.
How did you get access to staff?
In terms of the survey,
yeah.
Just different networks that I was involved in, I spread it among different groups asking for people to complete it.
And did they do that anonymously?
Yeah, it was all anonymously. It was just done through a SurveyMonkey, I think, which is an anonymous online survey platform.
Right. And did you go as far as extracting information out of the Official Information Act? Or?
Oh, yeah. So that was a channel that I used to get the information from the CCTV usage component of it. So I completed official information requests to all of the DHBs that had adult inpatient units operating in their area, and asked for them to provide data on the usage, the location of where the cameras were, and their justification or their reason behind including the cameras.
Right. What was your personal reaction to this when you first when you first heard? I mean, when I first read this report, I was quite stunned. Mm. I mean, it was a shock to me to learn that the privacy of staff and patients may be being infringed. What was your personal sort of response?
Yeah, and I suppose it's really tricky because I took quite a strong personal response to this. Like, it's quite clear in the spin-off article that I don't agree with CCTV being used in inpatient units, full stop. I think it comes across quite strongly. But the research that I actually tried to do, I wanted to be as unbiased and just sort of take a, you know, what is the international literature saying? Is there any efficacy for using CCTV cameras? What does that look like, and where can it be useful, and what are the limitations to that? So I really wanted to pull together all the information possible in an unbiased sense, I suppose.
So were people willingly, voluntarily, obviously voluntarily, but willingly giving you information about this subject?
In terms of the OIA process, I think that's one area that I found to be incredibly difficult. Some of the DHBs were open and shared that information very readily with me, whereas others, they just didn't want to share that at all. And that drew the process out quite a lot longer. They said perhaps it would jeopardise the safety of staff and patients if they disclosed that information, and that was the reason for withholding it. Mm. you know, and I had to challenge that and saying, well, why are the DHBs sharing this information and you're not? You know, what's the problem here? And so, yeah, that was one of the challenges, I suppose.
So those that didn't initially want to cooperate, I mean, what did you think about their attitude, that they were wanting to keep this secret?
Yeah, obviously when someone's not willing to share information, you become sceptical around its usage. I think that's even one of the questions I have and the responses that I did finally get from those DHBs in particular. I can sort of see gaps when I'm looking at that data and I sort of say, maybe they're not being 100% upfront, but they're just trying to provide a response.
Right. Mm. So how did you pressure those DHBs that weren't being very willing in their responses? I mean, you just went back to them?
Or? Yeah, I just put a complaint through the Official Information Act process and said that, you know, I really would like this information to be disclosed. Other DHBs have shared this, and so there's really no issue for safety. And disclosing this.
So some of the findings, how extensively is CCTV used in New Zealand's acute mental health units?
Yeah, and I think the spin-off article covers that particularly well in terms of providing that table, but I think it's, from memory, 12 of the 20 adult inpatient units in New Zealand currently have CCTV operating to a certain extent.
That's 12 out of, so there are 20 acute.
Yeah, so I think it's roughly about 60%, but that was at the time of completing the research back in 2017. Te Aho Mai, the county's Manukau inpatient unit, which has recently been refurbished. I'm sure, you know, some of your listeners know.
Well, rebuilt, in fact.
Yeah, so it's totally a fresh unit. So since the time when I submitted the official information requests up until now, they've actually put cameras in their inpatient unit too.
Right.
So that number's changed.
So when you make that statement that they put cameras into the inpatient unit, I suppose that's quite a general statement. It gives maybe our listeners the feeling that the whole hospital is under surveillance or under video surveillance, but
yeah,
that wouldn't be the case, would it?
No, absolutely, and I think that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to come on and talk a little bit more in depth about this on the radio is, you know, I don't want to... how can you say, like fearmonger or anything like that?
Alarmist.
Yeah, alarmist kind of, I suppose, in regards to these issues, because it is something that happens, but I want to really reinforce the fact that it's something that happens to varying degrees in different hospitals. I think there are about three or four from memory that have CCTV operating in what would be defined as, what I would define as treatment areas, which primarily includes things like lounges, corridors, and outside courtyards. So areas where what, you know, in terms of common law, what's been defined as treatment is any sort of interaction with staff. So that can be staff talking with a person who's staying in an inpatient unit to more sort of therapeutic group activities, those sorts of things. So all of that is the legal definition of treatment.
Is there any sort of evidence that these cameras maybe are not operating sort of 24/7, but when there is some sort of heightened incident that they may be turned on immediately to provide coverage of that event?
Yeah, that's a really good question. My understanding is that the CCTV is there and it's operating 24/7. But certain units don't always monitor that unless an incident occurs and then they want to review that incident retrospectively. And so they might say, okay, on, you know, the 5th of February 2019, this occurred at this time. We want to go back and review exactly what happened. And so then they'll access that footage.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's come back after a music break. I have to apologise to Declan and that I didn't introduce him today, technician.
That's all right.
He's waving his pad over his face.
I
think he's having a little bit of a hot flush.
I'm having a meltdown. I've sort of like got an imaginary geisha girl standing beside me trying to keep me from popping a fuse.
That creates all sorts of pictures.
I don't know. Am I the only one feeling the heat in here?
Well, I think so, yes. You're the only one waving your bat. You're mad at your face furiously.
You see, it's you guys having this influence on me. It's positive influence. Anyway, the check I've got for you today is from a lady called Jasmine Thompson, and it's called Like I'm Going to Lose You.
I found myself dreaming in silver and gold, like a scene from the moon. that every broken heart knows. We were walking on moonlight when you pulled me close. Split second and you disappeared, and I was all alone. I woke up in tears with you by my side, a breath of relief, and I realized, no, we're not promised tomorrow, so I'm gonna love you like I'm gonna.
From us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran. Did apologise to Declan for forgetting to introduce him this morning.
Oh,
and we're
how,
talking.
How rude.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking today to Karen Black, who is a former consumer advisor and now student advocate with Kahui Tu Kaha. In fact, Karen, you work on the Unitech site, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, absolutely. So just a 10-minute walk away, which is quite nice.
Right, yeah. Mm. So we were going to meet at the Long Black Cafe last week, I think it was, or the week before perhaps, but the Long Black wasn't open, so we had to nip down to Point Chef. But Karen has done this research on video surveillance in acute mental health units, and we've been talking about her methodology or how she went about getting this information. And we've talked a little bit about the parts of acute psychiatric units where it does operate. So, I mean, if it's in lounges, that is a place where there is, if you like, informal therapy going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
Not formal therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what is the definition of therapy? Is it sort of like a conversation with two people who are on the unit together? Like, that can be very therapeutic for people. Is it a conversation that happens between an orderly and a person who's also on the unit? Because that can be really helpful, and they have some really good connections to people who...
You mean the person that brings the meals in or
yeah,
brings
absolutely.
The tea in?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those sorts of people are often, you know, there and available and around, and people form connections with them and have conversations, and so that can all be therapeutic.
Yeah, well, they're often friendlier than the professional staff, in my experience.
I didn't want to go that far as saying that, but...
Well, I've said it for you. Yeah, I mean, this is a question that I didn't... put in, but your own personal exposure to mental health, is that something that you're happy to talk about?
In terms of when I use mental health services and those sorts of things, yeah, I suppose so. I guess it's I have a slightly different view of the experience now as to what I did some time ago, but really I think that's quite difficult because, you know, technically I was diagnosed as having psychosis or schizophrenia, and that diagnosis came about when I was quite young, in my early 20s. But now I'm quite devoid of using mental health services and haven't used mental health services for some time, and came to different conclusions in regards to my own experience and what that means for me and what was actually going on for me at the time. Mm. I don't identify with that diagnosis or... really some of the things that perhaps mental health services were telling me was going on.
So, I mean, please tell me if you're more comfortable talking about the illegal video surveillance than your own story, but I suppose in meeting you and talking with you, I did get the impression that you had some exposure to mental health services. I mean, can I just ask you one question? Was the diagnosis not correct?
I mean, it's a tricky thing to say because I'm not a psychiatrist with the DHM going through the checkbox of what's required to have that or not. I suppose some of the things that were going on for me definitely could have been that way, interpreted in that way. I just don't know how much help or usefulness there was in me in receiving that diagnosis and making any sense of meaning of my experience, which is what I'm more interested in, I suppose, in terms of what's going on for a person, what does that mean for them, and where should that go, as opposed to this is a diagnosis, this is what we're saying your experience means for you, essentially by limiting it to these categories or criteria. And that's that. So I think for me personally, diagnosis limit experience, whereas I'm more about opening up experience and exploring that. Right.
But, you know, I mean, psychosis, schizophrenia, my own experience was that many, many years ago, a psychiatrist had concluded that I was a manic depressive. He didn't pay me the courtesy of telling me that. He told my wife.
Yeah.
My relationship deteriorated with my wife, she used that diagnosis to beat me around the head. Well, you're a manic depressive. That's why you, you know, that's why you behave like this.
Mm.
And I said, well, where did you
this
ever
is
get
used
that?
To me.
well. Also, where did you get that idea from? Oh, yeah. Your psychiatrist in hospital told me that. And I thought, well, that's real helpful that he doesn't share that with the patient.
Absolutely. And that's quite similar actually to my experience. I was, I think, applying for life insurance or something really mundane like that, and that's when that information came up that I was had the diagnosis of schizophrenia on that. They were sort of like, well, what's going on?
But where did they ever find that out?
Because they have to look at your medical records, I think.
Okay.
So I disclosed that I'd had some contact with mental health services and they could see that I'd had admissions.
I was just going to say, if you don't do that, then that gives them a reason to negate the policy, so you're basically just making a donation to the insurance company.
Yeah, so you can get pinged for it later on down the track.
I was just going to quickly throw in there if I can. Sorry to cut your wind out now that I've stopped fanning myself.
I just wanted to say, and sometimes I forget what I wanted to say, but no, I'll come back to it. No, I don't. No, I've got it now.
You got it?
I have a bit of a brain fade sometimes. It's where people will sometimes say, my name, say, you know, obviously me, I'm Declan and I'm bipolar. I say to people, well, actually, you're not your condition. I have, as against I've, you know, I'm bipolar. So you're not actually sort of wrapping yourself as that actual condition.
You're not the condition.
So. Yeah. So instead of saying, hi, I'm Declan and I'm bipolar, well, no, I'm not. I'm Declan. I've got bipolar. Mm. That way you're not sort of, I don't know, maybe just a psychological thing, but I don't know.
And I suppose even in terms of what does bipolar mean, people who experience or have the diagnosis of bipolar, their experiences can vary broadly from person to person.
Yeah.
So I sort of feel by saying, you know, I even have the diagnosis of, say, schizophrenia, what's that actually telling people about what I experience? And it's nothing.
Yeah, and it's like... Yeah, it's like with bipolar, there's various types, rapid cycling, type 1, type 2, that sort of thing. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now.
Well, but unfortunately, there are all sorts of misconceptions around these diagnoses, aren't there? I mean, one is that those that have schizophrenia have split personalities.
Mm.
You know, if you're bipolar, I mean, it's a frightening descriptive, even like a manic depressive.
Yeah.
You know, that whole word of manic, I mean, you know, it's like, well... That person's likely to go out of control and do out of control things.
Is that a bit like me, sort of like if you've got bipolar, you're going to sit in a studio and fan yourself with your imaginary geisha girl?
Well,
something
yes,
like that.
It could well be. That could be your bipolar might be responsible for some of those thoughts.
I don't know why I was the only one overheating, but anyway, I'm going to sit quiet in the cheap seats now.
Right. Well, we've sort of gone off the track a little bit, so let's take another music break and we'll come back and talk to Karen about this video surveillance in acute psychiatric units.
That was a sneaky thing to do to me. He's just trying to get back at me, I think, now.
Yes.
I got a track here, actually, from a guy who is a Spanish-born singer and songwriter. He's currently based in Los Angeles. Taught himself guitar. Born on September the 1st, 1991. And at 15 years of age, he recorded his first cover song on YouTube. And his videos have received more than 400 million views and over 3.5 million subscribers. In 2010, he met producer Tim Johnson, who brought him to Miami. And this is Perfect from Leroy Sanchez.
I found a love for me. Darling, just dive right in and follow my lead. Oh, I found a girl, beautiful and sweet. I never knew you were that someone waiting for me. 'Cause we were just kids when we fell in love, not knowing what it was. I will not give you up this time. But darling, just kiss me slow. Your heart is all I own. And in your eyes, you're holding mine. Baby, I'm dancing in the dark. You between my arms, barefoot on the grass, listening to our favorite song. When you said you looked a mess, I whispered underneath my breath, you heard it, darling, you look perfect tonight. Well, I found a woman stronger than anyone I know. She shares my dreams. I hope that someday I'll share her home. I found a love to carry more than just my secrets, to carry love, to carry children of our own. Still kids but we're so in love, fighting against all odds. I'm gonna be alright this time, but darling, just hold my hand, be my girl, I'll be your man. I see my future.
That was Leroy Sanchez with Perfect. You was Take It From Us, 104.6 Planet FM, broadcasting here every whoopsie. You're not having that one. Every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30. I nearly said 3:30 once.
Oh, well, you did well with 12:30 to 1:30. That's absolutely accurate.
Yeah, it's bang on.
I'm host Sheldon Brown, and we're talking today to Karen Black, who is a student advocate with Kahui Tu Kaha here on the Unitech site, so you didn't have too far to come today, Karen. We're talking about what is deemed to be illegal video surveillance in psychiatric units. It's correct to say this is illegal, Karen?
It's the advice that I've been given when I contacted legal expert Chris Gledhill, who's a law professor at AUT. I sort of pointed to him the Mental Health Act and the section, I think it's in section 68 of the Mental Health Act, the patient rights section anyways. It sort of stipulates that no audio or visual recording of patients should be made without their consent. And so obviously this potentially can be classified as video recording. So that breaches patient rights in accordance with that legislation.
So as a result of posting some information about this on Facebook, there was some considerable response, and some people thought that there were notices up on the hospital walls and that this surveillance may have been mentioned in a sort of an information booklet. Mm. Have you seen any examples of that?
I don't. One DHB, I think it was Lakes District DHB, they actually provided posters on the walls informing people that CCTV was operating. I think if people are starting to see pamphlets and wall posters on the walls, then that would perhaps be a result of the sort of audit that I did and raising this as an issue. But to me, consent isn't putting a poster on the wall or providing someone with a pamphlet. It's two separate things. And part of the work that I did was in actually looking at sort of the consent process and how fraught that would be in an inpatient environment. Because you're always going to have some people who will say, yes, fine, I'm happy to have CCTV operating. I think it's a good thing. And then you're going to have some people say, no, I don't want this here. So how do you balance the the desires and the rights of both people, and how do you protect privacy in that situation?
Well, for those people who object to it, so are they then ruling out the opportunity to go to that psychiatric unit? And
but then the part of the problem is people go there against their own free volition. So people are brought there under the Mental Health Act and don't have a say in whether they actually want to go there or not.
So it's a complex issue.
Yeah.
Let's just focus a little bit on the detail of where the surveillance happens within acute mental health units. What does your research reveal on that?
So what came back in terms of that was perhaps that the most common area for CCTV to be operating was in areas that would think it would be operating. So that was...
Where you'd think it would be.
So sort of reception areas, front entrance ways where people first walk in and out of the hospital, vehicle bays. So that can be staff bringing people into the hospital, police bringing people into the hospital, those sorts of vehicle entrance in and out areas, and also medication rooms. So they were quite common places for CCTV to be operating.
Yes, but, can I just stop you there in terms of medication rooms? I mean, why would it be necessary to have surveillance in a medication room?
Yeah, and I think quite a lot of medication rooms in hospitals' environments probably have CCTV operating in those spaces to avoid medication errors and mishaps perhaps going on. Keeping tabs on perhaps what staff are doing with medication.
So do you think that this is a safety issue, that they, if there is an overdose and a patient might complain or have a serious side effect, they can go back and check how many pills are dispensed and that sort of thing?
So that would be one reason why it could be used in that space. I think the far bigger one is probably making sure that staff don't take medication
But isn't there a, well, yes, but isn't there a trust issue here? You know, this is a reflection on the staff, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think in mental health spaces, trust is a huge issue, full stop. You know, those environments aren't very trusting of anyone at all.
Gosh, that...
Do they not do what I mean, I haven't been in the ward since 2001, but do they not go round individually and say, right, here's your medication and stay there while they take it?
Yeah, so that still occurs, but my understanding of where some of the cameras, it's hard to explain kind of over through dialogue without sort of showing, you know, say like in this room you have a camera in the corner and it's just purely monitoring what the staff are doing in terms of taking the medication, counting it out, and then distributing it to the person. The person actually taking that medication, my understanding is that they would not come onto that. They would not be in view of the CCTV camera. So it wasn't the purpose of actually recording the person taking the medication. It was purely a staff checking.
Mine might have been just from on the ICU ward, because I think my head was with the clouds for about 5 days anyway.
But in terms of staff being videoed in a medication room, are they aware that that is happening, do you think?
Yeah, I think they're definitely, I think most of the staff, or all of the staff probably working in those environments are aware that CCTV is operating. And I've actually had sort of pharmacists saying to me that they find CCTV in that space very useful, because if something goes wrong, that's their system of accountability. They can review that footage and say, no, actually, this I did everything right here. So there's pros and cons to everything. Yeah,
I mean, often the medication is dispensed outside of the medication room, which could be an area where there is surveillance, because in my last experience of being in an acute unit, that area where I took the pills was really the lounge area, or a sort of a open plan part of the lounge, you know?
Yeah, so that's correct. And often people will come and bring medication to patients for people to take. And that's exactly why I think that having CCTV cameras breaches the Mental Health Act, because that's a clear example of a treatment. And if that's been captured on CCTV, like we know it potentially is in Whanganui inpatient unit, and also the Lakes District in Nelson Marlborough, I think, as well. So those inpatient units are clearly breaching the Mental Health Patient Rights Act.
Is that footage actually kept, and if so, for how long? Or is it just on-the-spot monitoring?
But that's a very good question. I think they have different DHBs, and this is part of the problem as well. New Zealand has no unified system in place, so all the different DHBs operate differently, and so some will keep the footage for 48 hours, some will keep it for 7 days. Some will allow staff to monitor that footage in real time, so from workstations. Others, you'd need to access security personnel to view that. And so there's really no standardised approach to this, which was one of my big points of concern, I suppose, that there's no overarching way that this is managed in our inpatient units.
Well, that would be the case with all operations of the DHBs. There's 20 or 21 of them, I think, and they all do their own thing, and I think the government is starting to object to that, and I think the inquiry into mental health and addictions has identified this as a major issue, that DHBs all operate sort of rather ad hoc and autocratically. So the opportunity for staff to monitor this footage, again, patients have the opportunity to look through into the staff area where most staff are working. You can see their screens. If they are monitoring any footage from that hospital, then isn't there a danger that patients could see that as well?
Potentially, and it's hard for me to say because I haven't been to the individual inpatient units where this is more of a concern, so I don't know the layout of them. From what I've been told, they were sort of older style inpatient units, and so that's why it was more of a priority for them to have CCTV so they could see in areas that were sort of out of staff sight from those sort of nursing station fishbowls, I suppose you could call them. So that was one of the reasons for it.
I mean, all of these acute units are lockdowns, aren't they?
Yeah, it's my understanding that all of the units are locked or have,
Right. Even the most recent one is Te Ahu Mai, and I missed an opportunity to talk to the two senior medical professionals there on radio. But the second most recent one is the one on your side of town, Declan, replacement to Taharota, and I just can't remember them. And I was taken through that, and I mean, I was very overwhelmed by the sort of nature of the prison-like nature of it.
Yeah.
You know, the doors, the thickness of the doors, the lockdown.
Yeah, and that was one of the units that actually didn't respond to my request for providing me with information as how many cameras they had or where they were operating.
Right. Yeah,
well, I might be able to get you that information because I've just spoken to my psychiatrist to renew my WIN certificate the other week. In fact, I just saw him this morning. But I was just going to say with the CCTV footage, in order for that really to be of use, I would think it would have to be real-time monitored, even if you only keep the footage for the day in case there's an incident, because if something's happening that involves somebody's safety, you need to know about it then and there. You can't just sit and suddenly go, oh, something's happened, let's go back and review.
Yeah, so when I was reviewing the international literature, that was quite an interesting point that came up. It sort of stated that real-time monitoring of CCTV is actually quite ineffective because when you're looking at a screen projection of what's actually occurring, it's quite difficult to tell what's going on without any audio. You're just seeing two people or a person doing something. And so that's quite difficult to know what's going on. You don't know what that person's thought processes are. It becomes quite 2D and depersonalised,
you need to be,
I suppose.
Trained in body language.
Or just trained in going out and talking with people.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
Like stop sitting behind a at the nurse's station, actually go out and interact with people.
Yeah. I mean, seclusion is clearly a very controversial process in our acute units and in mental health services generally. Is there any suggestion that those that are secluded are also on camera?
I think on camera in terms of... some of the DHBs responded in saying that they have CCTV operating in their intensive care areas, which is where seclusion rooms would be used. They didn't disclose more than that, but that would be quite worrying for me, I think, if they had cameras operating in individual seclusion rooms itself. That's something that has been alerted to the International Human Rights, I've forgotten the name of the organisation now, who sort of deals with that sort of stuff for prisons, who have in prison cells, areas of seclusion, they have cameras. And so that's been highlighted in that forum as being something that New Zealand really needs to get better at.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've raised the issue of prisons. I mean, are you aware of what sort of surveillance and how common video surveillance cameras are used in prisons?
When I was doing a little bit of research into this, I got quite interested in looking at prison environments too, because I think there's similarities.
Well, they say that over 90% of the people in prison have mental health problems.
That's right, yeah. And so there's similarities in that sense, and then similarities in the you're confined in a space sense. And so CCTV usage in prisons is fairly commonplace.
Well, also it is commonplace.
Yeah, it's used quite extensively.
And obviously the trust issue would be even less than it might be in a psychiatric unit.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to comment on that.
No, fair enough. Okay, well, let's take another music break. Declan, what have we got now?
Okay, well, I've got one here that the song was produced and released in August of 2018. Swedish DJ and a record producer by the name of Alesso, A-L-E-S-S-O, and it features vocals from English singer Connor Maynard, and I think I've played some of his tracks before. You're listening to Take From Us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting right here on Planet 104.6 FM every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30. And this is Remedy from Alesso.
I didn't know that I was broken until I found my missing piece. It seemed like every door was closing on me. You were so far out of reach. Drunk on the
with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And the words of that song, You Are the Remedy, which really reminds me that we are all personally responsible for our own mental health. And I feel that when we talk about mental health services, they are there, I guess, when we get critical and in crisis. But the rest of the time, well, even when we are in crisis, it takes personal responsibility to get through it. My last experience of acute care, it actually was Declan who came to see me and reminded me that I had a responsibility to this radio show, and that was the thing that got me to walk out the next day, prepare for that show, and front up on the day after.
I actually had an email contact with Pat. Who used to do She used to do the radio improv. Yeah. On Planet FM. She's now in Brisbane, obviously. And she was the one that said to me, you know, it might be ideal and do the world of good, because I didn't want to sort of be there if you...
You mean coming to see me?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was very much appreciated, and it did really, I think, hit home to me that I did have a personal responsibility to take it from us, and also to my own health and well-being.
Gave you a sense of purpose.
Yeah, well, we're talking today to Karen Black about video surveillance and acute units. I think it's fair to say that DHBs might claim that this is a safety, that these... devices are introduced for patient safety, staff safety. What's your view about that, Karen?
I think safety from who and safety from what. The international literature suggests that CCTV doesn't actually reduce violent attacks on staff or on patients. It doesn't stop people bringing drugs into units. It doesn't stop any of those sorts of things. What it does do is actually just provide a recording system. So then, say, if somebody smashes up some furniture and they want to try and recoup some money, then they have that on evidence that this person has done that and they can do that. So it sort of becomes a retrospective tool, I suppose, for potentially creating criminal charges against someone.
I mean, I think in your article in the spin-off, and do you have a link for that? Because somebody asked me whether there was a link for the spin-off.
I think perhaps if you just Google the spin-off CCTV and mental health, it should hopefully come up, but I'll be able to email that to you, I suppose.
Yeah, but in that article, I think you say that CCTV is dangerous in mental health units.
It currently, as it stands, the Mental Health Compulsory Assessment and Treatment Act prohibits the use of audio or video recording without patient consent. And so currently this isn't being adhered to, and having pamphlets around or posters on the walls isn't a consent process. So by DHBs blatantly disregarding the Mental Health Act, I think that's incredibly dangerous and can potentially lead to a slippery slope of other patient rights being eroded in DHBs and the Ministry of Health even turning a blind eye to this. I think that's really concerning.
Well, it seems as though everybody is turning a blind eye to it. I mean, did you, once you had published or had published the spin-off article, did you submit that to, say, the other patient rights groups or the Human Rights Commission or anybody like that?
So my process behind it was I got in contact with a privacy commissioner and I said that this is what's going on. The DHBs are currently following the privacy commissioner's guidelines on CCTV use, and so that's a good thing, but the privacy commissioner's area isn't the Mental Health Act, so they couldn't really comment in regards to that specific element, which is the main concern. And I did push it through other consumer networks and things like that to try and gain some interest and traction around it. But I think perhaps the biggest, if people are unhappy about this and they feel that they have had a recent inpatient admission and that there's been CCTV recording in treatment areas, I'd really encourage people to actually make a complaint and go through that process and say, hey, this isn't good enough. You've violated my rights, and actually go down that route, and hopefully that would also create some attention to this issue.
So who would you suggest that they make that complaint to?
the Human Rights Commission, straight to the DHB or to the ministry.
Right. Well, thank you, Karen, very much for your insights into this very good paper in the spin-off. So you're saying that if anybody just went online, the spin-off, video surveillance and mental health, that would bring it up?
That should do it, yeah.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll go to our community notices,
Declan. Take it from us, Community Notice Board.
Boy, you were on the job there, weren't you? Now, there's a lot happening. I got the newsletter from Drive Direction out in Manukau City. There is so much happening in the next 2 or 3 months that what I would suggest you do is go to their January Drive newsletter on Drive's website. There's meditation and movement workshops. There's their bipolar support group, which is supported by Drive. There's abacus workshops coming up, running right through from the 4th of March to the 25th of November. They're also congratulating Te Whangai Trust for being shortlisted as a semi-finalist for the 2019 Community of the Year in the Kiwibank New Zealander of the Year Awards. They have an AOD peer group every Wednesday from 12:30 to 2, so there'll be information there on the website, and also Connect Supporting Recovery, which funds Drive Direction, has peer employment training that I think Declan has been telling you about over the last few weeks. What else have you got,
Declan? Yeah, I just want to know, firstly, we used to have a men's group on at Connect, and that then went through Phil Galloway at Taharoda, but I'm thinking it might have been a good idea to start that again. Anyway, peer employment training. That's with Connect Supporting Recovery, and it's at 28C Lambie Drive in Manukau, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it starts on February the 14th. It runs through to March the 19th, with a graduation on the 20th. Anybody that's in the county's Manukau area with an interest in working in peer support can apply for that. Light morning and afternoon tea provided, so you've probably just got to take your lunch there. Contact Rachel Maloney. Her cell phone number is 021-625560, or you can email her rachel.maloney at connectsr.org.nz, and that's rachel.maloney at connectsr.org.nz.
Yeah, and I think Rachel might be away for a short period of time, so Denise at Drive Direction is another very good contact there. Just the issue of asking for help, I got something on social media saying that asking for help is the new black. And it says here, we totally get that asking for help is hard, because not only can it feel awkward and embarrassing, but we don't like to feel like we are a burden to others, and we fear that people will say no or that we'll look like a failure. Sometimes we can also be a bit stubborn and proud and think we can do it all ourselves, even though we might be in that place of overwhelm and stress. We totally get it, but we need to change it, because if you get better at asking for help, then so will your best friend and your mother and your sister and your best work friend, and will create a ripple effect, and then asking for help will be the new blank, right? So who's in? You good at asking for help, Karen?
I suppose it's something I'm trying to get better at.
Right?
Yeah.
What stops you asking?
Oh, shit. I suppose stubbornness.
Stubbornness.
Yeah, being a little bit too independent.
Well, it's stubbornness was one of the things, and being too proud as well. Well, we're off air just about.
A little bit of a few moments.
Got 20 seconds there. Yeah, what have you got? Something else
I was just
going
to quickly say, too, there's a risk of losing family and friends if you sort of, you know, tell them you need some help with anything. Basically, all I have got is Vaughan Cruikshank of Junction Fair. Peer support and advocacy is going to be appearing at Braveheart's first meeting. It's in Tauranga, their first meeting for the year, 7 p.m. And that is at 59 Koromiko Street on Tuesday the 12th of February. And he'll be talking about his experience and helping others and that sort of thing.
And Bravehearts, of course, is a support group for people, loved ones who are looking out for people with addiction.
Yeah, and I just say go to the website bravehearts.nz, nothing else on there. And that's us, I think.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for listening. And thank you to Karen as well.
Thanks for having me.